This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 7th of October 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 30 minutes, did the US military commit a war crime when it bombed a hospital in the Afghan city of Kunduz? Médecins Sans Frontières, the aid agency which ran the hospital, has called for an independent investigation. My guests Tim Marshall and Raffaello Pantucci will give us their views on that and other stories, including this. The Kremlin announces it has fired cruise missiles from the Caspian Sea on ISIS targets in Syria. But why does Russia prefer sending rockets from the sea to airstrikes from its fighter jets? And also ahead, we'll ask if people are falling out of love with the Kindle. The UK's largest book retailer, Waterstones, has announced it will remove the ebook readers from its stores. That's all ahead here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. My guests today are Raffaello Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at the London-based think tank RUSI, and Tim Marshall, editor of the whatandthewhy.com and former diplomatic editor of Sky News. Raffaello and Tim, welcome to you both.
Thank you.
We'll begin today with the ongoing aftermath of last weekend's bombing of a hospital run by Médecins Sans Frontières in the Afghan city of Kunduz. The US military finally admitted yesterday that it had been responsible. This was the fourth version of the story it had released since Sunday. But Tim Marshall, was it a war crime?
Probably not, because it wasn't intentional. However, under international law, you are supposed to, if you know it's a hospital and you are being fired upon from within the hospital, under the Geneva Conventions, you are supposed to inform the occupants, we are about to fire on you. That did not happen. But of course that didn't happen because the Americans say they didn't know it was a hospital. So go back to the beginning. They have changed their story four times, but it does appear, which is, you know, has made them look even worse than they did. The Afghans did call in the airstrike. And the Afghans, it appears, did not say this was a hospital.
Although, actually, in one of the versions now, the US is saying, well, actually, no, we had special forces nearby and we might have called it in. It's all a little hazy.
You're right. There's been the four versions. But through the four versions, what you get is that the Afghans called in the airstrike, but it was the American special forces that had the communications with the AC-130 gunship. So they were talking to. They were the ones who actually had both eyes on and the comms. So, again, it goes back to, did they know it was a hospital? If they did and they didn't warn them, it is a war crime. However, I've been looking into this International Humanitarian Fact-Finding Commission, the IHFFC. Apparently, the United States and Afghanistan are not signatories to this convention. And in order for them to investigate, as MSF has asked them to investigate, all parties must consent. So if the Afghans don't consent, there's not going to be that investigation.
And Raffaello, that goes to the crux of the problem here, isn't it? That, you know, we often talk about international law and whether something was legal or not. And in this case, it's irrelevant, isn't it? Because, as Tim has just said, the body that is set up to investigate these crimes, they're not signatories to.
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think that in some ways what's, it's clearly a human catastrophe what's happened, and it's a disaster that this MSF hospital was hit and these people were killed, and clearly there was a huge, balls up, quite frankly, in terms of the communications. And I think the legalities of it are all very interesting and important, but in some ways there's another interesting aspect to this story that we haven't really touched upon, which is the fact that the air capacity that the United States is able to provide to the Afghan National Army is said to be one of the key components that the Afghans say they really need and they're going to not get if the Americans sort of pull out. And so in some ways, that's the interesting aspect about this, you know, because the point is the Afghans keep shouting about how they need a strong ANSF and they don't have it at the moment. And the fact is the West isn't giving them the army that they want, which is a huge army with lots of tanks and planes and other weapons and other things, because they feel like they're a big army. And it's frankly a very expensive force. And the West says, well, you don't really need that. What you need is a counterinsurgency army, which is light, which is mobile and everything else. And the air capacity, well, we'll determine that a bit ourselves. But it's very clear that in response to the air capacity being tracked back, the Taliban have started to mass in larger forces. You start to see large sort of takeover and large sort of attacks. And so as a result, we are seeing there's a very interesting sort of question here about, you know, the air capacity is clearly very important, but in this particular situation, it's clearly been used in an incorrect fashion. And yet at the same time, it's clearly one of the key components the Afghans keep saying that they need. And I think that in some ways is the longer term ramifications of this story, which I would wonder a bit about.
On those longer term ramifications and the US actions in Afghanistan, there is also a fundamental issue here, Tim, isn't there? In the US needs to really be able to explain coherently what they're still doing in Afghanistan right now. And we could ask, you know, 10 different officials from various parts of the US government, and we would probably get 20 different answers as to why the US is operating Afghanistan right now.
I think the answer is they're saving face. You go back, I mean, Obama, with his coherent foreign policy, gave the Taliban a start and an end date. Oh, don't worry, we'll be gone by then. You just need to hang on until then, which is what they've done. Americans are busy moving out. Most of the other forces have moved out. And what has subsequently happened is that the north, the Taliban is getting increasingly strong. And in the south, it's very strong, especially in Helmand province. Mm. So that leaves the center. So what the Americans have to do now is shore up the center to make sure that Kabul pretends to still be the capital of a unitary country, even though it isn't. That the president, although he's a de facto mayor of Kabul, can still call himself the president. And so just make it look like it wasn't a disastrously over quick pullout. And the last thing, sorry, quickly, Steve, is that I'm pretty sure now the Americans will leave a larger force behind than they had planned to.
Raffaello, is this part of the problem of nation building? In that if a military like the US goes into a country to defeat an opponent, you know, in this case, the Taliban, and then pulls out, what happens next is, well, look, we've defeated the Taliban, what happens next? You know, we can't be there forever. But if actually then your goal becomes, we're going to help create a modern democratic Afghanistan, then, you know, you have to stay there. Or the moment you leave, these things start happening. You can say, well, all the work we've done before was for nothing.
Right. I mean, look, I think it's a question of what ambition was set and the wildly unrealistic sort of realities which are sort of portrayed, that we're going to create some sort of Switzerland in Central Asia.
Not
you know?
Originally, but sorry.
Well, I mean, it did come in very quickly. You're right. Initially, the idea was we're going to get rid of the Taliban, we'll get rid of Al-Qaeda, move on to somewhere else, right? But in reality, then after a while, the conclusion was, well, no, we need to sort of create institutions, we need to build the peace. You
and
know?
Some of that did come from a good place, sort of didn't it?
Oh, it's all well-intentioned, but, you know, in reality, how are you going to create this? You've got to create a whole set of cultural institutions, which take a long time. There's a reason they're cultural institutions. It takes years for these sorts of institutions to develop, for practices which, frankly, people have survived on for a very long time to sort of prosper and succeed. So it takes a long time to sort of develop the kind of community that we have, for example, and the sort of civil structures that we have in the West. It takes a long time for those things to develop, and for them to be expected to be developing in the wilds of Afghanistan with the sort of lack of infrastructure that you have, with the sort of differing tribal cultures and communities, the sort of the frankly fake borders that you have in a lot of these parts of the world, which is sort of doodled on a map by someone sitting in the Foreign Office here. You know, you're dealing with a reality there which is wildly different to the one that you're sort of operating from here. So to expect the sort of institutions we have here to just naturally pop up there is very difficult to imagine. Having said all of that, I think it's always important to remember that you do have levels of education in Afghanistan which are much higher than you had before. You do have internet penetration, you do have women going to school, you do have a whole set of things that have changed. So I think to say that it's been a total disaster is incorrect. But I think to say that what maybe people had thought was the bar of what we were going for has been, frankly, written off as wildly unrealistic. Now the question is, what is it we're going to end up with and how can we preserve that?
Tim, there's a broader issue here about how Western militaries operate alongside local militaries that perhaps are not as strong. And we're seeing this in Iraq right now. We've seen it in Yemen over previous years, about how the forces on the ground, the local forces on the ground, will try to use the military might of their Western partner, not necessarily in the way that those Western partners will want. I'm thinking in particular in Yemen when Ali Abdullah Saleh would call in drone strikes on people he said he swore were al-Qaeda, but actually just turned out to be his political opponents.
And the Saudis, who carried out most of the airstrikes in Yemen, had very little compunction in carrying them out, and I'm not convinced care very much that that's what it turned out to be. The Americans get hideously embarrassed. I do believe they are genuinely contrite, having done this. But I don't think the Afghan forces would have any compunction about calling in. This is not yet proven, if they were being fired upon from the hospital grounds, they'd have no compunction about calling that in. But on the wider issue that you began with, yes, there's a problem of discipline. Many developing countries' armies, the officer class runs away, abandons their soldiers. We saw that in Iraq this year, in Ramadi and elsewhere. And then you also have this lack of comms. I mean, NATO itself has a communication problem. I remember all the way back in the Kosovo War, the Americans ended up not bothering to talk to anybody else because there was so many. The Dutch were saying this, and the Brits were saying that, and the Americans were saying this, and not all the kit was even on the same wavelength. So the Americans just went
on the same wavelength.
Not on the same wavelength. Literally on different frequencies and unable to connect. Now magnify that with the Afghans, who are they're not trained how to communicate with the fast jets that are flying over them. And so it all becomes secondhand, and then you get mistake after mistake and tragedy after tragedy.
I mean, I would sort of add two things. First is the forces that you're working with. And I think one of the more depressing stories, which I read recently in the New York Times, was a big expose a few weeks ago, if I recall correctly, in which there were some journalists have spoken to a lot of U.S. forces who'd been working with the Afghans, the NSF forces that they'd been sort of building up. And they were saying how the officers were essentially raping young boys from the villages in the areas that they were sort of controlling. And this was happening on a sort of regular basis. They kept reporting up the chain of command, and the chain of command were just sort of disregarding it because they needed to work with this guy because in that particular province or whatever, he was a significant figure and they needed him on side to be able to fight. So that's one side of the equation. Who is it you're stuck actually working with? On the other side of the equation, the really depressing conclusion I'm increasingly coming to is, what foreign policy tools do we actually have? You know, if you're looking at a conflict, right, how do you resolve it? Now, if we're getting to a situation where politically it's impossible for us to send in large amounts of forces and heavy metal because our, political calculus these days is that just doesn't fly anymore at home, then we can't do that. So we can do special forces. They can do a little bit, but it's really about building up local capacity. And yet, time after time after time, it's been proven not to work.
Well, it's
sad. Repeating in every single context, it just doesn't seem to work. The forces don't seem to be training up. And I don't know if it's a failure of training or if it's a failure of this as a particular tool. And is there another tool we need to somehow find?
On that point, Tim, I wanted to ask, when I look at the stories I've covered in the past, you've had the Somali Coast Guards, which were trained by the Europeans and then turned into pirates. Mm. You've had the Congolese army that was being trained by the UN and the EU and then turned actually worse than the rebel groups.
The Mujahideen in Afghanistan.
The Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 1980s. Slightly before my time. But yes, has there ever been an example, in fact, that either of you can think of, where this has actually worked, where Western military has trained a local military and it has been, on the whole, a success?
There are examples of, you could look at some of the border forces that have been trained in parts of Central Asia, other parts of the world, where they haven't actually, let's put it this way, fallen apart. In some ways, there's a lot of situations where we have done training, but they haven't necessarily been tested on the battlefield in the same way as the, for example, Iraqi army or Afghan army have. So I think there are some cases where we could argue it may have worked, but I don't necessarily know if we have a huge evidence base.
Tim?
I can think of examples where the British military has trained up other militaries to a decent standard. I can't think of any examples where then they have gone into battle alongside each other and performed well. Very briefly on that New York Times story about the sexual abuse of teenage boys, I'm just surprised it took so long that anyone wrote a story about it. When I was in Afghanistan, it was, everybody knew. This happened on the British bases as well. Yeah. I remember being down in Sangin and the guys, they didn't like it, but what are they going to do? This was part of the Afghan military's culture. They even called it Love Thursday, because I'm afraid that the young T-boys, we knew what happened on a Thursday, and this is that culture, and what's the commanding officer supposed to do about it?
So then, to take a step back, when we look at all these issues, Raffaello, what can Western nations do differently? Is there an alternative strategy?
Well, I think there are lots of, clearly I think we do need to do something, because local capacity building is going to always be something we need to do, because frankly, sending in the forces that we have is just, in the sort of numbers that you need, is never going to work. And frankly, sending invading force to a country, there's very few examples where you can say that actually it really changed things for the better and you're able to, there's a need to build up a local command. So we clearly need to rethink and refocus how we're actually doing that. There's clearly an enhanced role for diplomacy. I also think that, increasingly you're looking, you're already seeing this with a lot of Western forces when they talk about it. They focus on building up a sort of niche special force capabilities to be able to respond to military threats in a very targeted and specific way.
Okay, we're going to move on, to Syria. The Russian Defense Ministry announced today that its warships in the Caspian Sea had launched almost 30 rockets at ISIS targets inside Syria. According to the Kremlin, the caliber cruise missiles had struck targets associated not just with ISIS, but also al-Nusra as well. Tim Marshall, this is a next step for Russia. Perhaps. What does it tell us, and what's the broader story tell us about what Russia's trying to do?
On one level, it tells us that they're using Syria as a practice ground, and very successfully. I keep hearing year after year that Putin is doesn't do strategy. He just sort of does individual events one after another. Well, they're nearly always successful. This is the first time the Russians have ever used cruise missiles. And they've done it with impunity. They've done it successfully. They fired 26 cruise missiles across two sovereign states, out of the Caspian Sea, across Iran, across Iraq, hit their targets, it would appear, inside Syria.
Well, I mean,
Syria.
You say successfully, given we're talking about Russia, which isn't exactly a free and open democracy, and we talk about Syria, which no one can report from.
I think their cruise missiles are probably as accurate as anyone else's.
Yeah.
And also, this is very arguably, they could say legitimately, because the government of that country, which is still represented at the UN, the Assad government, has said you can do it. So the Americans are, I think, making themselves look a bit silly on this one, because they keep saying, oh, you're hitting the wrong targets, or you shouldn't be there, you shouldn't be bombing, and yet they are doing exactly the same thing. The Russians have been quite transparent about this. We support Assad, and we're going to use our military to support Assad. They've been quite transparent. They've done it brilliantly. They brought their forces in under the radar brilliantly. I mean, I'm not making a case whatsoever in favour of what they're doing. I'm just saying that what they're doing very, very well. 26 cruise missiles flew 1,000 miles over two sovereign states, hit their targets.
Raffaello, do you think this changes the situation somewhat for the US in terms of how they deal with Russians' involvement in Syria?
I don't know that it does any more than yesterday, really. I think we'd seen the Russians do it, right.
Yeah.
They were engaging, and that was kind of it. I think what's interesting was the fact that there seems to be such close coordination between the Russian air power and the Syrian ground force sort of response. That's interesting and shows a very tight sort of connection there, which we haven't really seen. I mean, I know they've been doing it a bit with some of the YPG forces, and some of the Kurdish forces up in the north. But, I think what's frustrating to me about this story is I keep seeing people putting out authoritative maps that say the Russians hit this target. Another one says the Russians hit this target. And I don't know. And since we don't have the direct information coming from the ground of where the bombs are actually landing, we've no real idea if it's hitting FSA targets, if it's hitting Nusra targets, if it's hitting al-Sham targets, or if it's hitting ISIS targets, or even maybe by accident Assad forces targets. I just don't know. So it's very frustrating. But I think the key thing is that the Russians have shown that they have an ability to quickly take the lead and put themselves on a front posture and frankly get everyone else very shaken off. And this sort of clarity is something we haven't really seen on the battlefield in Syria for a very long time.
Next stop, Baghdad. As I understand it, an Iraqi military some advisors flew into Moscow today, and they're even talking about, well, okay, clearly the Americans are not winning the war against ISIS inside Iraq, and the Iraqis appear to be at least willing to talk to Russia about when maybe you'd like to do what you're doing there here as well.
Well, it was interesting, wasn't it, that when Russia first started bombing inside Syria, that the first proper conversation that was held between Russia and the US was when a three-star Russian general went to the US embassy in Baghdad.
And told them, and then said, by the way, we're up in an hour, get your planes out of the space. And the Americans, they had the gall when Putin then went to the United Nations. I'm not anti-American in any way. It's just that when you see naked hypocrisy, you have to say it. They span to the White House press corps, which is not the most aggressive press corps, shall we say. They do tend to be fed by very short spoons. And they fed them this line that the Russians were desperate for the meeting with Obama, and the Russians really wanted to... And the Americans were falling over themselves to get to the Russians and talk to them to say, would you please tell us what's going on?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the one caveat I'd add about the sort of Iraqi thing was I think that's a bit more about posturing. I think that's
I don't know it's actually really going to happen.
Yeah. They are having that discussion, but I think that the calculus is very different there.
Yeah,
In fact, I wonder more about the relationship between Iran and Moscow over this whole thing, because that one is very complicated. I don't think anyone's really got sight of it at the moment, but that, I think, is the important dimension that we don't really know of this picture, and I think actually probably determines a lot of it.
And then you can paint a picture, if you really want to, of of Russia, associating itself with the Shia forces across the Middle East, whether that is Iran, Syria, and also now, of course, increasingly Iraq.
Well, they've got their own domestic Sunni problem that they're trying to deal with. I mean, if you look at some of the strikes which they've reportedly done, and in Latakia, it's clearly against Nusra and Ahrar al-Sham forces that are connected to the Shishani communities, the Chechen communities and the sort of Caucasians who are fighting out there.
And the you should see the Middle East press over the past few days, the newspapers, who are predominantly Sunni newspapers, for want of a better expression, they are to a newspaper, to a man and a woman, against what's going on, and what the Russians are doing. And it is precisely because the Russians have intervened on the side of Shia Iran's ally, Assad. Yeah, I mean, you brought up the Shia Sunni thing. I'm afraid it's as clear as it's ever been that is a big element of what's going on.
On that issue, Tim, is there a danger for Russia that they overplay their hand and that they, that they create more enemies here for themselves?
They've got a big foothold back in the Middle East. They've got lots of forces back in the Middle East. They're telling the world, we stand by our allies. And the people listen. And the people in Eastern Europe, they know that Washington is a very long way away and Moscow's quite close. I don't think they're overplaying their hand.
The people who didn't like them will still not like them.
Yeah.
That's not going to change.
But
so I don't know
proving.
That there's more. I don't know there's more enemies that they're making. I think that it's just strengthening, frankly, the hand that we already know.
They stand by their people. Yeah. Obama threw Mubarak under a bus.
Tim Marshall, Raffaello Pantucci, thank you both very much indeed. We'll take a short break. When we're back, we'll talk a little bit about refugees and hopefully, if we've got time, a bit about books.
See that man sitting opposite you on the subway, lost in another world? Or the smart woman scribbling notes while having her flat white? Well, here's what links them. They're both listening to Monocle 24 on our robust new, upgraded and free radio app that simply and seamlessly lets you tune in live or download shows for later enjoyment. Just think, you too could be settling back with wise words from The Big Interview, being briefed on the world of business with the entrepreneurs, or just enjoying great music with the sessions at Midori House. Come on, download the Monocle 24 app today, stick on your headphones, and have informed fun on the go. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, my guests today, Tim Marshall and Raffaello Pantucci. So far this year, more than 500,000 migrants and refugees have crossed the Mediterranean Sea, hoping to enter Europe. Today, the European Union launched a new operation to intercept boats in the southern Mediterranean. The Operation Sophia enables naval vessels to board, search, seize and divert other boats suspected of being used for smuggling. It marks a clear change from the EU's other operations so far, which have been focused on surveillance and rescue only. Tim Marshall, they've certainly spun this quite well today. Does it actually change anything? And is it actually as humane as perhaps they've tried to suggest it is?
I think it does change things. I think it is quite meaningful. I think it will have an effect. Humane, no. This is actually part of the hardening of the hearts of Europe. You can make the argument that it's for the best. This is phase two of a three-part operation. It's called Operation Sophia, which, as you know, means wisdom. Okay, the EU, the Navy...
It's not quite named after that, is it? It's named after this girl who was born on one of the ships that was coming over, right?
Yeah, but Sophia means wisdom, and in their wisdom, this is what they're doing. They're sending the EU navies down there. When they find a smuggler's boat, not a dinghy, I suppose, they're going to t- attach something on it and tow it back to Turkey and say, get off. They will then either destroy the boat or take the smuggling leaders to Italy to be prosecuted there. This tells the people, don't bother getting on the boats, and it, allegedly, and it tells the smugglers, we're going to come after you. Phase three will be to extend that to Libya, but that would require either a United Nations Security Council resolution, which I think is doable, or it would require the Libyan government to say yes. So
which
it's
one?
Part of the hardening of the hearts. I think it will have an effect, but of course people will then find other routes, and they'll have to be... dealt with.
This is about locking the door, isn't it, and saying sorry guys, Europe's full, we don't want you.
I mean, look, it's in a way it surprised me it's taken so long to get to this, because you know, I mean, it's clear the political calculus has been going for some time in this direction. I mean, you can't just have this, these numbers of people coming over and the sort of political ramifications that it's clearly having within Europe to not start thinking, okay, well, you know, on the one hand we can try to, you know, deal with the people who are coming, but we do need to try to stop the flow. And if you can't get into places like Libya because they're just far too chaotic, you can't actually stop the flow in places like Syria and Afghanistan, well then you're going to stop the travel patterns and you're going to disrupt those. And that's clearly what this is aimed at doing. I think, though, Tim is 100% right, that yes, this will close the door to some routes, but others will emerge.
So,
Ukraine. You look at a map of Europe and you'll see that you can go up through Bulgaria and Romania into Ukraine, take a sharp left into Poland. Before you know it, you're into Germany. And that they will try other routes. But I do think this will have an effect. And in the long term, they're trying to keep people close. By the way, there's a second political aspect and financial aspect to this. And that is why Erdogan was in Brussels this week. And that is, look, Erdogan, leader of Turkey, we'll give you loads and loads of money to build refugee camps in your own country if you could just cooperate on this.
If you were a refugee, how would you actually be able to get into Europe? Because this is the thing I've always struggled to understand with any sort of asylum and refugee policy, is that on the face of it, all Western nations say, well, we accept refugees here, we accept that, you know, under the Geneva Convention, we should give them refuge. And yet there are no legal routes to actually enter any of these countries.
I'm not sure that they aren't, no. I mean, people can seek asylum and...
How? How do you actually get in the first place? You can't get on a plane, because
you can get onto a plane, yeah.
Yeah, you can have, if you have a visa,
how do you get a visa?
You said there was no way in. You have a visa, you land, and you say at that point, by the way, back home, they're trying to pull my fingernails out, I want to be a...
How do I get a visa?
There's sort of a long history of people getting to...
No, but this is the problem. It's like, how do you actually get a visa?
Well, yeah, most people don't.
So well, the question is, do you necessarily need to get a visa, or can you bribe your way through at the airport at the other end? And once you're on the plane, then that's it. Then you just get to the other side. I mean, there's a long history of people showing up at like Seoul Airport, sort of North Koreans who show up there, have no documentation. They manage to bribe their way onto a plane somewhere in China. They get into Seoul and then they just sort of hang about until someone in authority comes.
But again, I'm sorry, I'm going back to the legal way. You're talking about bribery.
You show up to an embassy and you say, I am a persecuted person from this place. Here's my proof of doing it. I want to come to your country. And then it's up to that embassy to resolve it.
So we're only arguing with you because you said there was no way. We agree that there is a
small way. It's complicated.
What's behind your question is that, yes, the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people don't have visas.
Yes.
How do they get there?
That's true.
Okay, very finally, we've got a minute left. I want to talk about Kindles. It was supposed to be the saviour or perhaps the killer of the publishing industry. And we've discovered today that Waterstones, the biggest bookseller here in the UK, has said they're not going to sell Kindles anymore because no one's buying them. So a question for you, Tim Marshall. Where is your Kindle?
You failed to say that I've got a new book out called Prisoners of Geography, which is on sale in Waterstones.
We've only got 45 seconds left. Where's your Kindle? Do you still know where it is?
I've never bought a Kindle. I don't like Kindles. I like reading newspapers. I like reading books. And it's not a surprise to me. And on my own book sales, the book sales are vastly outstripping the Kindle sales.
Raffaello, who also has a book out, we're not going to name that one as well, I'm sorry. Do you own a Kindle, and if so, do you know where it is?
I do not own a Kindle. My mother owns two, though, but I do have the app on my iPad. That's the way I get around it. What I find funny about this story, in fact, is that it's James Daunt, who, of course, is famously of Daunt Books, who's now migrated over to Waterstones, who's the one who's now killing the beast which killed his original shop. So
There's
a sort of irony.
Long may continue. Worth pointing out that in other countries, Germany, for example, no one reads e-books anywhere. They still buy proper books.
Quite right, too.
There we are. That is Midori House. Thank you very much for joining us today. The show was produced by Marcus Hippy, researched by Gaia Lutz, Federica Romaniello, and Antonia Maltzhauser. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. For the next half hour, it's The Atlantic Shift. Then at 1900, it's The Entrepreneurs with Danny Jacopelli. Midori House is back at the same time again tomorrow. That's 1800 here in London. That's 1300 if you're listening in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.